Mining is backbreaking, dangerous labor. Accidents in mines can lead to disability or even death. But even when a worker walks away from the mines, they may not walk away from the health problems associated with mining. In the 1990s, miners sued Britain's National Coal Board after research indicated a link between lung disease and coal dust exposure. That landmark lawsuit and the data supporting it is the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. Mary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me in the studio are regular panelists, John Baylor, Chair of Miami Statistics Department, and Richard Campbell of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Johnny Jacobson. Jacobson is an editor with International Newswire, AFP, and a data journalist who has covered everything from Scientology to homelessness. Jacobson's also the author of an article in Significance magazine titled Defending the Data, Examining the Battle Between Miners and the Coal Board Over the Data That Linked Coal Dust to Lung Disease. Thanks so much for being here today, Johnny.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure.
I'm just going to start off by asking you what propelled your interest in this topic.
Well, it was a kind of bizarre kind of serendipity. I was actually taking a year off from my job. I was in Birmingham, at Birmingham City University, studying for an MA in data journalism. And it was around about that time that my father died. So my way of coping was to notify the employers, start writing an obituary, do what I could to help on that side. And it was when I contacted Brian Tarrant at Significance magazine to say, look, could you put a wee word in, because he used to be a member of the society, the Royal Society of Statistical Society. And he said, I'll be happy to put something or send something to one part of the website that can do that. But, you know, you should really do an article on this guy, because he'd read the draft that I'd written of the obituary that eventually went into the Scotsman. So I had to think about it. I was a little hesitant at first, because obviously there are problems writing about something which is, in a sense, has a personal link. But in the end, decided it was a story worth telling.
What was the biggest surprise when you started doing the research for this story?
I think I have to say that this was a case that was extremely important to my father for all kinds of reasons, because decades of research was being called into question, research which he had actually supervised and analyzed and vouched for 20 years. But what I hadn't realized that the stakes were far higher than that. This was about claims for miners who were suffering from respiratory diseases, which just weren't recognized at the time as being industrially related. At the time, the only game in town, as I was told, was pneumoconiosis, which had been acknowledged as an industrial disease. But these guys were suffering from emphysema and chronic bronchitis, and they couldn't get any compensation or any benefits. Mm-hmm. So what was in fact happening is miners were dying of industrial disease and not getting compensation. This case was about changing that. And as it turned out to have massive implications for thousands, tens of thousands of miners.
From reading the article, it was one of the things that was interesting was they tried to make an argument about the data on non-smokers. Could you talk a little bit about that and what was problematic?
Yeah, the argument here was the initial defense, shall we say, that was taken by British Coal was that, well, look, they may be that some people are having a few health problems from coal dust, but that's not the real problem. The real problem is they're probably just these guys are smoking, and it's about lifestyle, and they're not looking after themselves. And so the serious health problems that they are experiencing are actually down more to the smoking than it is to the coal dust. And they would say there's obviously going to be a degree of problems with coal dust, but there's no scientific evidence to suggest that, the coal dust was the problem. And that was a major hurdle that they had to get over. And cases had fallen in the past on that hurdle, I think. So what the new approach that was being taken was to be marshalling the evidence that was produced by the coal board itself to try and defeat that argument.
So what was your dad's training? What was his background, and how did he get involved in this story in the first place?
My father trained in statistics and epidemiology. Before he worked for the Institute of Occupational Medicine in Edinburgh, he had a few other jobs down south. But it was once he arrived in Edinburgh and he had to take a crash course in in this particular field that he was fully into industrial health. I think there's an anecdote on the website as a kind of taster to the main piece, in which his boss told him to prepare a projection based on the existing evidence of how miners would be health-wise in terms of pneumoconiosis. And he had to do a complicated calculation, which turned out to be something that could have been done on a computer, as one of his colleagues later told him. And that was just one of the things he had to do. But there was a lot of statistics. Yeah. There was a lot of epidemiology. And one thing I noticed when I was reading all the papers, the background to this, is there was the degree of suspicion between the medical profession, the medical specialist, so to speak, and the statisticians and the epidemiologists. And it took some time to overcome that mutual suspicion. You may know more about that than I do. I don't know.
So could you, for the listeners, can you define what epidemiology is?
You've put me on the spot now.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Let's see if I can bluff my way through it.
You know what? I'll try to bluff my way through if you can't. How about?
Well, you can give me marks out of 10. Let's see how I do. As far as I can understand, at least in this context, epidemiology is the science of discovering how diseases develop, and that's particular interest was in industrial health. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily about how to cure it, but it's about looking at how it spreads. Tell me how close I am.
I would give a guest no less than 10 out of 10, just because I'm, you know, that's part of being a good host. No, I think you did outstanding.
Johnny,
that's a relief.
I have a question for you. So I grew up in Appalachia here in the United States, coal mining country, and certainly there were conversations about miners' lungs being unhealthy after coming out of mines for a very long time, and some idea dating from the 1950s that this might possibly be due to coal dust exposure. What was it that this study your father was involved in that became so controversial, and how was it that the coal board who commissioned the study was trying to undermine it?
This is what's so shocking about it, because effectively what was happening was the British coal, as it had become, was effectively trying to trash the evidence, decades of research that was carried out by its predecessor, the National Coal Board. This was something that was launched in the 1950s with the advent of the National Health Service and the nationalisation of the coal mines. There was a new kind of public-spirited attitude to industrial health. And the idea was to get 24, 25 sample mines and to try and find out what the problem was, what was causing these illnesses. But it wasn't so long before that. They weren't even acknowledging pneumoconiosis.
Yeah.
At one point, there was a very distinguished scientist called J.S. Holden who said, no, actually, coal dust is really good. It actually immunizes you against things like bronchitis. He got completely the wrong end of the stick. I mean, he was acting in good faith, but he was completely wrong about it. And it wasn't until the late 40s, I think, or the late 30s, early 40s, that it was finally acknowledged as an industrial disease. But what this research was doing was a very systematic large-scale study with trying to introduce as many different account for as many different factors as possible to try and find out what the problem was it the amount of dust, was it a quantity of dust, so they could get some idea of what could be done to limit the damage. And to do that, they had to accumulate a lot of data, do a lot of medical testing, not just the x-rays, which picks up pneumoconiosis, but also lung capacity tests, which measures a different kind of it's a different kind of health measure, which is much more important in this case.
What do you think? What motivated the attack on the original research? Was it just to save money? Was that what was going on?
I mean,
liability.
It's difficult to be sure, but yeah. Well, no. Let me stick my neck out. Yes, I think it was about damage limitation. One of the things that didn't come into my story was a couple of memos that I found in the National Archives, British Coal. We're discussing the case around about May 97, I think it was May and July 97. And they were saying, look, we knew we were going to have a hard time winning this case. They were discussing legal tactics and how to limit the damage. And they included delaying tactics. They included tying people up in litigation. They didn't want to make it easy. They just wanted it to go away, because I think they knew that it was an open-ended open-ended case in terms of damages, and it proved to be one of the biggest settlements that was ever paid out. And we're talking about £2.4 billion that was eventually paid out in compensation. Mm-hmm. But they dragged it out. And as they fought this case, as they fought it getting to court, as they fought it in court, miners were dying. And that's really what's so scandalous. Mm-hmm. It's not just about defending the honour of the research or the honour of the institute. It's about the fact that miners were dying while British Coal fought a case that I think they knew they didn't have much chance of winning. And I think that's where the real scandal mm-hmm. lies, not in the science and statistics, but in the fact that they defended it so long. And in fact, I spoke to Gareth Morgan about this, and he had a few ideas as to why they decided to fight it out. But I have that in a soundbite, which you might be able to use in any case.
There was what was known as the magic train to Cardiff. If you were working in the valleys in a mine, you were breathless, you would be sent on the train to the pneumoconiosis medical panel in Cardiff. These men would be disabled, couldn't breathe, but they would go down to the Cardiff where they would be told there was nothing wrong with them. Because what they were being told is they didn't have pneumoconiosis, and it wasn't accepted that there was any other condition that could cause breathlessness. So they're ill, they go to Cardiff, and where they're told they're okay. Hence the term became the magic train to Cardiff.
But the problem was it came down to money.
Mm-hmm. So in your story, you suggested that your dad was a little reluctant to get involved in kind of the court part of this story and some of the issues related to that. What was kind of the transition point? What was the tipping point for him to get involved?
Well, you're right. He was initially very reluctant. I mean, my father was had very strong political views, but he made a very clear distinction between his activism as a kind of committed citizen. I mean, political activism was something that was the duty of anyone who cared about things to engage in. But that was something that was entirely separate from his role as a scientist. And he didn't want to be caricatured as someone who was biased or who was getting mm-hmm. politically engaged. He wanted the science to speak for himself. One of his colleagues, Fintan Hurley, who recently retired as the science director of the Institute, said that my dad used to say, "What is the data telling you? What is it?" And that was his point. It wasn't about preconceived argument. It was about looking at the data and seeing what came up. And I'm sure you come across that in all kinds of scientific inquiry. You shouldn't be trying to fit the facts around your theory. You should be looking at the facts and telling them and listening to what they're telling you. Mm-hmm. So when he came under pressure from the miners, basically the miners' lawyers said, "Look, we've been to other people, and they're not interested. We have a long specialist who's trying to digest all this complicated statistics, but it's not really his field." And that was Robin Rudd, who spent several weeks in the witness box. And so he was very much a kind of a last-minute, last-gasp call, because it only in the opening weeks or the opening days of the trial realised that this was the line of defence that the British Coal was going to take, that they were going to trash the data itself. Mm-hmm. So that we need somebody who really knows that data clearly. And he said, "Well, look, I don't want to be a defence witness. I don't want to be getting paid for this." He would only do it on the basis that he would get expenses only and no payment for his expert testimony. And in the end, that's what happened. They had to subpoena him. You get a grand title from the chief lawyer of Britain, in which he was summoned to give evidence before the Queen's Court.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington with Miami University Statistics Department Chair John Baylor and Media Journalism and Films Richard Campbell. Today we're talking with data journalist Johnny Jacobson. Now, Johnny, this article very much is a discussion of this data, this controversy, but also your father, Michael Jacobson's role in this suit. And earlier you mentioned sort of the complications of reporting on something that's so close to you. I know here in our journalism program, we are constantly telling our students that you don't report on things that are close to you, right? You may, because you need to maintain that critical distance. As you were sort of navigating this story and trying to do it justice to the miners, to the data, and to your father, how did you navigate that sort of that issue of reporting on something that you were so closely connected to?
Well, the personal element was something I had to be careful about. I mean, it was an advantage as well, because when I went to talk to people and say, "Look, I'm doing this article about this court case, and my father was an expert witness and helped me win the case," I mean, the doors opened. I mean, on his reputation alone, people were willing to talk. And people said some very kind things to me about my father's work and the contribution that he made to this court case. But at the same time, I had to be careful about looking through his personal papers. There were exchanges with colleagues, which were obviously not things that were ever meant to be made public. And I had to make decisions about when to respect privacy. And also, if he was corresponding with somebody else, I need to try and make sure that if I was going to use that material, I need to make sure the other person knew about it. Even if I wasn't naming them, it was really just a question of checking my facts and making sure I hadn't got anything wrong. I mean, it also has to be said, there was a personal element to this battle. I mean, people's reputations were made or damaged on the basis of this. Yeah. And I had to make a decision, do I want to get into that? And in the end, I decided no, because as far as I'm aware, the experts on both sides were giving their evidence in good faith. And it wasn't a question of, cynical people in the pay of the coal board. No, they were saying what they believed. So I made an earlier decision just to stick to the science, which I think is also something that my dad would have preferred. And in fact, my father's former boss at the Institute of Occupational Medicine wrote me an email, which basically decided that, saying, never forget that your dad made a very clear distinction between the politics and the science. Yeah. And that was what guided me in my work on the article.
Very good. Keeping it on the personal level, your dad's training was in statistics. Your early training was in English literature and journalism. So what I want to know is that journey from being an English major to getting your master's in data journalism much later, and it sort of ending up being able to write an article like this, which, you know, as a former English major, I thought this was a terrific article, and I understood almost everything but the graphs and charts that were inside. So,
well, in that case, we're in the same boat.
Yes. So, talk a little bit about going in English literature when your father was a statistician.
Well, let's just say it was a steep learning curve, and even when I was doing English literature, I did a year study in philosophy, and I remember he gave me a great deal of help on the basics of syllogistic logic and stuff like that. I think I still have his notes on my undergraduate undergraduate thesis in philosophy, in which he was very kind but also completely surgical in his That was very sobering. All that was a long time ago. That was 30 years ago. But I was gradually moving into the data end of things over the last few years. And I wasn't so much discussing that with him as discussing people like Martin Gardner, you know, that wonderful writer on science. Yeah. I came in a sense via people like him, who was a real polymath, capable of writing about anything from Alice in Wonderland to the advances in quantum physics and actually making it understandable. So I'm a journalist. My job is to make things clear. Mm-hmm. And it was really just a question, when it came to tackling this article, I had to try and make complicated ideas really simple. I was helped by Bledin Hancock, the union leader, and by Robin Rudd, the lung specialist, and also by Gareth Morgan, who gave these wonderful summaries of what actually happened during the court case. They were right up there. Because in the end, it's not about the science, it's about the people involved. And what the most difficult part of the argument was trying to explain my father's defense of the data. And in the end, what made it really clear and allowed me to cut a lot of the scientific material out was what Gareth Morgan told me. He says, in the end, it's about the signal, not the static, because even if there were minor errors in the research, and my dad was quite clear that this was not perfect, the whole mononucleosis field research had its flaws and that had to be acknowledged. But if the overall message was still the same after all these mistakes and caveats have been taken into account, then that suggested the basic research was sound. And that seemed to me the best way of putting it, rather than get buried in data, which I didn't fully understand, obviously. But it's been a real education for me, and I hope to look a bit further in that, because I know this is still very much an issue in other parts of the world, in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm.
You know that there was that Morgan quote about comparing this. There was a metaphor about radio signals and the noise.
Yeah.
And what the signal
That's
had
the
to be stronger to get
minds.
Through. And it made everything clear to me when I read that meta. It was a metaphor that helped me understand what was going on here. So I appreciated that.
Well, yeah, I was so glad to have him say that. You know, when you're in an interview and somebody gives you exactly what you need.
Oh, yes.
And that allowed, that really solved, it really undid the knot. It really solved the problem for me. It was a great relief. I'm glad it was as much help to you as it was to me.
You know, this was really a great way to honor your father. I mean, I think that's a remarkable testimony. I want to congratulate you for that. When you were looking at kind of the evidence here, and it, you know, did, so clearly you agreed with your dad's conclusion at the end of the day, but did you start out thinking, gee, I wonder if this really is true? I mean, did you start out saying, well, I'm going to look at this and see if I'm convinced as well, or how did you approach the stack of data and all the information you were going to go through?
Well, I had the advantages of knowing the ending before I got to the story. So inevitably, I'd be approaching the story in a different way because this is something that happened a while back. But what I hadn't appreciated was how important it was and how much money eventually was paid out to the miners as a result of this case, not just because of my father, but also because of the evidence for the other experts involved, including Robin Rudd, the health, the lung specialist. So I approached the story as I know what the result was, and I wasn't going to presume to try and question the science. I was looking at why was it so important? What was the attack on the research that was being made, and who was making it? But really, having read the judgment, that one of the first places I started was reading the judgment, it was clear to me that there was no doubt about it, that the research was sound. And so I didn't have an approach where I was going into this with an open mind. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I don't think there's any point in second-guessing a judgment that happened 30 nope. years ago. If there was something new to be uncovered, it was somewhere else. And in fact, what I found that I think was new, simply covering the fact that the research had been challenged in the first place, which didn't get much coverage at the time because most people reported on the judgment, not on actually what happened in court. That was a new angle. But also these memos, these British Call memos, they were, for me, were quite revealing. That's not so much science, though. That's politics.
Yeah, it seems like it's harder to do what you've done, which is basically kind of build up the story. And a lot of times I think there's this real sense of let's get to this ending. Let's just talk about the punchline without the setup. Mm-hmm. And I think that you were trying to tell the story of how the data and the evaluation of it led to this story.
One of the challenges, in fact, of doing something out of the archives, finding a way of creating the jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's true. You went to school as a data journalist. You know, so you got journalists here and you've got a statistician here. Talk to us about what does one do to become a data journalist, given the course of study you followed?
Well, I was lucky in that I was able to take a year out fairly late in my career. And I'd already been doing data graphics, news graphics at AFB, which is a different way into it. And I have a long background of writing and researching. But what I was hoping to do was to pick up some of the tools of the trade in terms of coding and approaches, the more technological approaches. It has to be said that there are journalists half my age who were coding like crazy when they got there, and I was still paddling in the shadows. And I have to accept that there are limits to my skills in that area. What I can do is I can tell a story. And so I learned the basics of R and a little bit of Python, but I certainly wouldn't promote myself as a data journalist in that sense. But what I try to do is to take complicated issues and simplify them. And statistics is something I can get to grips with. I can understand why they're important. I can understand the logic of it. So it's really about it's really science writing is what I'm doing as a data journalist. There are other people with other skills who can support and help and enhance the work that I'm doing. But I'm really a storyteller with just with a few fancy bells and whistles on.
So what's next for you? What's kind of the next big story that you're going to tackle?
Well, I'm back to the day job, which is working as a desk editor at AFP, an international news agency, which keeps me sharp. But I want, if I can, in my spare time, is to continue on this issue of industrial health. I've been talking to some people over in the United States about the situation in the United States, and there are stories to be told there. But it's difficult to come up with something new when you're so far away. And I think there's been some Pulitzer Prize-winning journalism in this area, and I don't pretend to be able to reach those heights. So what I'm looking for is stories perhaps closer to home, either in Britain or even in France, in which I can apply some of the skills that I picked up in the last year in Birmingham with Paul Bradshaw. to stories here. So, for example, there's a great operation in Britain, you've probably heard of it, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and they've developed a local network of journalists to look into things like homelessness and use statistics and freedom of information requests to try and get a proper idea of the story and also put human faces on it. And I'm just wondering whether we can't do something like that in France as well. There is something being done at the moment, but I'd like to see if I can't apply some of the skills and the lessons learned in Britain to doing something similar in France. But that takes time, and I don't have a great deal of that.
Before we go, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about sort of what was the legacy of this, the judgment in this case?
It was an extremely important judgment, and it was fairly uncompromising in coming out in favour of the union that brought the action in favour of the miners and against British Coal. It said that British Coal did not take sufficient measures to protect the safety of the miners, but also that the attack on the research which was underpinning the miners' claim was not valid. And in fact, by the end of the trial, British Coal had basically retrenched and withdrawn their position on that. So that was fairly done. That was fairly unequivocal. What did happen is a massive program of payments was instituted to pay compensation to either to the miners or to the widows or to the surviving members of the family. But even that took a long time to get organized and paid out. So I would say I think it's something like more than half of the payments were made not to the miners, but either to the widows or to the families.
Oh, wow.
And though we're talking about large numbers of people receiving compensation and quite large sums in some cases, it was, I think, the largest class action and the largest set of compensation paid out in Europe at that time. I don't know if that's still the case. But the fact is, a lot of those miners never lived to see the money and never lived to see any sense of justice being given them. And I think that's what makes a lot of people angry. Certainly, I find it very distressing to see that.
You point out at the end of the article that the British Coal and the National Coal Board no longer exist, but there is something called the Coal Authority. And at the time you wrote this, they had not responded to you. Did they ever respond to you?
They didn't, I'm afraid. But it may simply be that the people who are really responsible and involved in this are no longer working. I expect many of them at my father's age have retired, if they've not already died. So it may be that getting the chain of responsibility that far back is very difficult. But I am pursuing this story, particularly on the issue of the British Coal memos, and I'm beginning to get a lot of very angry responses. We run a short piece in the Daily Mirror, which is a British tabloid. Yeah. So I don't think this story has given up all its secrets, and I'm hoping that we can push a little harder to get some kind of accounting for what was done, because those memos and even the way they conducted themselves in the trial, I don't think it bears very well on British Coal or the government at the time. So watch this space.
Well, Johnny, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter, Apple Podcasts, or other places you can find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu. Or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.